welcome to the podcast for Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. This is the message given on Sunday, July 19th, 2015, by Tom Job from the book of 2 Timothy.
This is from 2 Timothy, chapter 4. This is the last thing that the Apostle Paul wrote before his death, and it may have been very, very shortly before that. In chapter 4, reading in verse 6, I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time has come for my departure. I have fought the good fight. I finished the race. I've kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. Do your best to come to me quickly. For Demas, because he loved this world, has deserted me, and he's gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia. Titus to Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, because he is helpful to me in my ministry. I sent Tychicus to Ephesus, and when you come, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas, and my scrolls, especially the parchments. Father, I do ask you to help us to understand these beautiful words and what they mean for us. For some of us who have decisions to make, and for others of us who are afraid of certain things, for others of us who are afraid all the time. We hate the way it feels. We're tired of it, and we don't want to be that way anymore. Help us to understand these words. In Jesus' name, amen. So anyway, I got home from, what day is this? Oh, you're here, so this is Sunday, I guess. But I got home from Portugal it was last Sunday at midnight, which the time I was on was 6 in the morning. And it's just been crazy because I was at a Young Life camp over there. And one thing I forgot is they stay up so late. Like every night it's like 12:15, 12:30, 1 o'clock. You go to bed. The last time I went to bed at 1 o'clock, I don't know when it was, but it was so crazy. So the camp ended really on Friday night. Saturday, all the kids left. And then we kind of had to close everything up. And there was just us who were on what they call the assigned team. And then there were volunteer leaders and people on staff. And so we moved from the camp to a hotel in downtown Lisbon because we all had flights out on Sunday morning. And so they said, all the leaders said and all the staff people, okay, so tonight we're going to go out and go to a restaurant and eat and just spend the evening together laughing and talking. And I thought, this is going to be awesome. But I also know this is going to be so late. I mean, they just go forever. And so I knew it was going to be 1:30, 2 o'clock before we got back, 3 o'clock. And I just thought, I don't know if I can do this. But anyway, we had to take 2 subway trains, and we got met at a certain place in downtown Lisbon. And one of the girls had found some kind of restaurant or something and made a reservation. So there was about 20 of us together. So we're in downtown Lisbon where everybody's hanging out. All the different people in Lisbon are hanging out. And we're in this restaurant, and it was, you know, about 9:45. We got there, you know how it is. And then we were eating and getting our food. And the whole back wall of the restaurant was a black and white photo from the 1920s of a lady who was wearing just kind of a sly smile. And that was about it. And I thought, well, I mean, we're in Europe. I know that's the way it is. And you just have to get used to it. That's the way they do. But anyway, about 10:30, there was a red velvet curtain and it closed. And in front of that picture, and I thought, what does that mean? And then they said, And somebody went up and said, are they going to do a show? And they said, yes, they're going to do a show. What kind of show is it? Well, it was basically a strip show. And then we were like, what? We don't want to see it. And they're like, well, you're kind of in a strip club. And we were like, what? How did we get into a strip club? And they said, well, don't worry. It won't start till 11:30, quarter after 11 or 11:30. So you have time to get out. So they said, guys, let's hurry up and eat because we have to be out of here by 11 o'clock because they're going to do a show that we do not want to see. And then there was a British guy with his name, Dylan Jones, who was awesome. And about a quarter to 11, there was a bunch of guys coming in and he said, here come the lights. So anyway, 11 o'clock, we're out of there and just standing on the street. And some people were saying, you know what? I've got to get up at 4:30. So we really need to go back to the hotel. And I was like, you know, I do too. I need to go back. I'll just go back with you. And I knew that if we hadn't gotten out of that place, it was going to be 2:30 before we ever got out of there. And I just saw Romans 8:28 on that whole thing. And I thought, I'm going to be in bed by 12. This is awesome. And just like, and you know, just God worked it all out, I guess, in a way that just sent someone to help me get out of there. And at 12 o'clock, I was in that bed just thinking, this is great. And Ben, who was a younger guy who went with me, they all went to get ice cream and walk around after that. He got in at 3. So there you go. But I thought, wow, I am an old person trying to do a young person's job, you know, just because I never thought that. That's what I would think is, oh, I get to go to bed at 12 o'clock. Because we're inadvertently in a stripper show. So awesome. There was when Paul and Timothy, when they first met, I guess Timothy wasn't quite 20 and Paul was about maybe 50. And so at this point, you know, Timothy was in his mid-30s. When Paul got out of, he had been arrested, and he was in he wasn't in prison in Rome, but he was under house arrest. That lasted about 3 years. And when he got out, he was in his mid-60s. And Timothy was in his mid-30s. And Paul was thinking, at last, I can live my dream. I am going. And Timothy's like, where? Home? Spain, baby. This is going to be awesome. I'm going to take the gospel as far as the world. There's a city on the west, on the northwest coast of Spain called Finisterre, which means it's the end of the world. This is the end of the world as we know it. I'm going to take the gospel to the end of the world. I mean, if he had known that there was an America, when the Spaniards and the Pilgrims got to America, the Native Americans would have been handing them, you know, the four spiritual laws, because Paul would have been there first if he had known there was that place. He's like, I'm going as far as I could go. And Timothy's starting to think, when does a brother begin to take it easy? When do you start to think about retirement? And when do you start to think it's time for you to enjoy yourself and slow down a little bit? Do you never? And I don't know if Timothy started to think about, by the way, this whole story of serving Jesus and all that, when does this story start to have a happy ending? Because this thing is not getting easier. It's getting tougher. There's a place right after the verses that we read in 2 Timothy chapter 4 where Paul said, you know, he had said to the people at Rome, I can't wait to get there to see you guys because I've got so many friends there and I know we're all like best buds and everything. But then he said, you know, when I was on trial, his first trial, in Rome, He said, nobody came. I thought we were friends, but maybe I thought we were better friends than we actually were. And Timothy's like, this thing is getting tougher and not easier, and it's getting worse instead of better. Like, as far as like the churches go and the spread of the message of Jesus and the people of God, I mean, you would think these churches and everybody falls in love with Jesus and they grow like crazy and it spreads like crazy. But in Paul's first letter to Timothy, he said, yeah, there's something bad happening in our churches. The thing that Paul believed more than anything is that the one dynamic that is the most transforming in the human psyche and the human mind and the human heart is when a person's heart can get its mind around the message that when you accept this gift that's absolutely free and you have a free start and you come to know the love of God as your very dad, and when you believe that and you understand how free it is, that will change a person more than any other thing. I got to tell those kids, you know, just about these Portuguese kids about accepting the gift. And when you accept the gift, you wind up having a dad in God that maybe you've never had a dad that was a good one. But you've always had the dream in your heart of the dad I wished I had. There was a woman named Kathleen Norris who has written a bunch of beautiful books, but she was a fifth grade teacher, and she said, everyone, I got to where I expected this, but if you had a kid that was just trouble and, you know, just always causing trouble in class, there would come a day when you would give the class an assignment and that kid would write something and it would be the most beautiful thing you've ever read. And so they were talking about metaphors, like this is like that, the sun is like a beach ball or something. And so they had to write a poem with metaphors. And when she saw his title, she was like, there it is. The title of it was My Very First Dad. I remember him like God in my heart. I remember him in my heart like clouds overhead, like strawberries and bananas when I was a kid. But most of all, I remember his love as big as Texas, where I was born. And she knew that this kid's dad had left his mother when this boy was 6 months old, and he had never known his dad, but he always had a dream. And I told him, even if you don't have a clear dream, Jesus told a story about a dad who lost a son, and he waited for him every day. And when the son came home, the dad ran to him, running and yelling and hugging him and kissing him, hugging him and kissing the stinky, nasty kid. And no probation, no punishment, no parole, just a gigantic party. And people look at that and say, this is not good. I mean, you have to make kids pay the consequences of the stuff that they do. And God's like, sorry, sue me. I'm having a party, if that's okay with you. And that every time a kid accepts the gift, and I told these kids that if you accepted the gift, the instant you accepted it, there was a gigantic party in heaven with angels screaming and flying and God singing. There's a verse that said that's what he does when you accept the gift. And they're thinking, the greatest party ever, and I'm not even invited to it. And I told them, you know what? The party's not for you. The dad said in that story to his other son, I had to have a party for me. I have been so sad. I have missed this child so long. The party's for me. So I told those kids, if you accepted the gift, there is a gigantic party going on for you. If you didn't accept it, and you don't have to accept it, the choice is yours. But one choice you don't have, if you choose not to accept it, is that God is going to miss you every day and every night. That's not your choice. That is going to happen. And he's going to wait for the moment when you come home. And Paul's thinking, that message right there will change a person. You don't have to promise to clean your life up. You don't have to promise, I'll never do this again. You can't say that stuff. You don't know that. And it doesn't matter, because when that message gets in your heart, it will change you. And there were other people who were going behind him saying, no. That is too free. It is too easy. It's going to create irresponsible people. So we're laying down some rules. If you think you follow Jesus and you eat this, 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 and this, you can forget it. You're not following Jesus if you eat that kind of stuff. And sex, oh my goodness, it's always bad. And Paul's like, God made it. It's awesome. You know, like in marriage, when two people get married, it's a private party that they can have that God just, it's how he teaches them about his love. No. It's always all fleshy and sweaty, and it's never a good thing. And maybe you can do it twice a year and see if you can have some kids. Only when God isn't looking, but it isn't. And Paul is like, you know, and he's telling Timothy, I mean, people are saying this kind of stuff. It's not getting better. It's getting worse. And in the world at large that he knew, as the message began to spread, the world wasn't getting brighter. The world was getting darker. There was a guy who became like the king of everything. A guy named Nero in, I guess it was like 53. And people thought he was a pretty good guy. I mean, he seemed like he was calm and all that until he started like getting all jealous of his family members and knocking them off. And it's like, that's never a good sign that things are going to go well. People start, you know. And he wanted to do this renovation thing of the city of Rome and build statues to himself. Like when you're in Lisbon, there's Napoleon, everywhere he went, he built the Arc of Triumph, which is just kind of like a big door. Nothing changes except now you have to walk through this door that says, this is mine, welcome to my world, I now own it. Like he did it everywhere. So Nero wanted to build that stuff. So he started a fire and burned down 10 of the 14 districts of Rome so that he could, you know, on July 19th, in 63 AD, and they weren't happy with it. So he said, I didn't do it. You know who did it was, those Christians did it. They're such troublemakers. They're the ones who did it. And he started blaming it on them, and then he started arresting him, and then he started persecuting and torturing them. And Paul and Timothy were in the city of Troas, and I don't know, maybe they were just like sitting out and eating, and all of a sudden, these guards pull up in this chariot, and they said, there he is. And they grabbed Paul, and they dragged him off. And Timothy, Paul said to Timothy, I remember your tears in Troas. You know, he was like, you know, when Gandalf, you know, goes down that thing with the Balrog, and he just says to Frodo, fly, fool. And Frodo's just like, no. And Timothy's just like, no. And there he goes. He went to a dungeon. It wasn't any house arrest. He was thrown into a horrible dungeon. And Timothy didn't know until he got a letter about 3 months later. It was this one, second one he had ever gotten from Paul. And it's like, he's alive. He is alive. And I'm so pumped. And Paul said, I need you to do me a favor. And I need you to come before the end of October, because winter's coming when nobody can travel. And I didn't have a chance to get this when they nabbed me. But I need my coat. It's cold here. And I need my scrolls. I need my scriptures. I need some encouragement. I need you to help me. And Timothy's like, if I go there, I'm going he's basically asking me to risk my life. I mean, if I go to Rome and I go to see him in the shadow of Nero, should I do it? Should I not do it? I don't know if I should do it. Biblical scholars are unanimous in agreeing that whether or not he made it before Paul was executed, that Timothy went. And the reason that he went, it wasn't because he was brave, or because he wasn't. He never was. He was never brave or bold or wild at heart. It was because there's something that Paul called him in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. He said, Timothy, one thing about him is that he's faithful. And I think of all of the Christian superpowers, that is the most boring one. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm reliable. Awesome. And I'll always, you know, do my thing, no matter what. Until you think about what it means, the word faithful is a participle. It comes from the word faith. It's a participle used as a noun, sometimes as an adjective, from the verb to be, and it means to believe. The word to believe or to be a believer, like Timothy is a believer, that Paul said, I know he believes. The word belief comes from another Greek word, the word petho, which means to be persuaded, to be convinced. That's one thing about Timothy, is that he was a person who was persuaded. Like he believed. He believed the message. He believed the simple message of Jesus. And he believed it so much that he was persuaded that it was true. And he was convinced that it was true. And people that are persuaded that that simple message is true are the bravest and the boldest and the wildest of all people that there are. Like when you just think about the message, what do I believe about this message? I believe that Jesus died for me. I believe he died for the world. I believe he died for me. And the reason that he died for me is because he loved me. And even though instead of getting easier, my walk is getting tougher, and I'm having problems, and maybe I'm, you know, they always say, you know, as you get older, you have problems you didn't even have. They say, how do you know you're getting older? You sit in a rocking chair and you can't get it started. You know, you sink in your teeth into a steak and they stay there. Everything hurts, and what doesn't hurt doesn't work. Every time a pretty girl goes by, your pacemaker opens a garage door somewhere in your neighborhood, you know. And it's just as you get older, you have problems that you didn't have before. James says, count it all joy, not if, but when you encounter various trials. You're always going to have them. It's not going to get easier. It's going to get tougher the whole way, because he says it's testing your faith. Like, how brave I am? No, not testing that. Like a lot of times when people mess up, I guess I wasn't strong enough. It wasn't a test of your strength. It wasn't a test of your bravery or your boldness or your wildness. It was a test of your faith. What do you believe? When it becomes difficult, I believe that God loves me because Jesus died for me. I believe it, and I'm not giving up. When I went to Portugal, Lee knows this, Patsy knows this, Tina knows this. I asked God to give me, this is a little secret, but when you're the camp speaker at a Young Life camp, they usually give you like a super nice place to sleep and like a room all to yourself, because you have to think, and they kind of baby you a little bit. But this camp wasn't, it was a Young Life camp, but they had to rent it from another thing. And it was kind of shabby and run down, sort of. And I prayed, Lord, give me a place to sleep, because I don't sleep with dudes. I don't sleep in a room full of dudes like they do at these Young Life camps. I don't know if I could do it. So please give me a room to sleep in. And when we got there, Ben and me, we had been up all night talking on the flight. And they said, let us show you where you're staying. And they took us to, there was like 6 bunk beds in the room with dude stuff in them. And I thought, Lord, I asked you. And he said to my heart, you don't need what you think you need. You make me do this to you, son. I'm like, you don't need the stuff that you think. And I didn't. I slept like a stone every night. And in the middle of the week, I was so proud of myself because I was like, I'm doing it like Lee does it, like Devin, like Cam, like Corey, like Travis, like Sam, like Thomas. I'm doing it like these guys. I'm doing Real Young Life stuff and I'm doing it. I am rocking this. And they were like, I asked him, did I snore last night? Maybe. I'm like, well, Yinzar the one that put me in here. So there you go. Oh, man. And when it gets instead, and I believe that Jesus rose, is risen from the dead. I believe that he died for me, so I know he loves me. I believe he rose from the dead, and so he owns me. Okay. You know, Paul said, if all I knew is that Jesus died for me because he loved me, then I would live my life to honor his memory like Private Ryan and then, you know, beg people to tell me that I'd been a good person or whatever. But because Jesus is risen from the dead, he loves me today. And Paul said, he died for us so that those who live would no longer live for themselves, but for him who died and rose again. And there's this thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul says, you're not your own. But you have been bought with a price. Like, he has loved me so much, and he loves me so much that love, I mean, I'm just kind of obligated to love him back. It's just the way love is. And because he's alive and he gave everything for me, love calls me to give everything that I have to him. So I don't belong to me, I belong to him. And instead of getting better, if things get worse, I don't really care. It's not my life anyway. It's not my body anyway. It's not my time anyway. It's his. And I think about when people go into retirement, that is awesome to not work your job anymore because you're going to do something else. But if a person starts to think, because now I can finally enjoy my time, and I can enjoy my golden years, and I can enjoy myself, it's not your time. Love has bought it. These are not your golden years. They're his. You are not your own. There's this thing that I read the last week. I've read it before. It is so brilliant. It's called The Screwtape Letters. It's a book that C.S. Lewis wrote. It's basically like a captain in the devil's forces, and he's writing letters to somebody that's under him, coaching him on how to tempt this person. It is so amazing. But one thing he says is, you have noticed that nothing throws your person into a passion so easily as to find a track of time with that he reckoned on having at his own disposal unexpectedly taken from him, an unexpected visit when he was looking forward to a quiet evening. He regards his time as his own, and he feels that it's being stolen. You must therefore guard this in his mind. The curious assumption, my time is my own. Let him have the feeling that he starts every day as the lawful possessor of 24 hours. You have a delicate task. The assumption that you want him to go on making is so absurd. If once it was questioned, even we don't have a shred of argument in its defense. The man can neither make nor retain one moment of time. It all comes to him as a gift. He might as well regard the sun and the moon as his own private property. When I speak of preserving this assumption in his mind, the last thing I mean is for you to furnish him with any arguments in its defense. There are none. The sense of ownership in general is always to be encouraged. Humans are always putting up claims to ownership that sounds equally funny in heaven and in hell, and we must keep them doing so. Produce that sense of ownership not only by pride, but by confusion. We must teach them not to notice the different senses of the possessive pronoun, the finely guarded differences between my boots and my dog and my servant and my wife and my father and my master and my country and my God. They can be taught to reduce all of these senses to that of my boots. And all the time, the joke is that the word mine, in its fully possessive sense, cannot be uttered by a human being about anything. Wow. So, you know, if it gets worse rather than better, I don't care. Jesus is risen. He owns me. It's his thing. He can do whatever he wants with it. And I believe that he's coming back. That's the message that I believe. And I believe that he's coming back to take me home. And when does it get happily ever after? It's not really going to get happily ever after until he comes again on a white horse. And his eyes will be as a blazing fire. And there will be a name written on him, on his robe and on his thigh, that says King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we are going home then. Until then, we are in a fight. And if it gets darker rather than brighter, well, I don't expect anything else. And I'm going to fight every day for love, for my joy, for faith in him, to love other people. And I expect this to be a battle every day. That's what I believe. And I think that's what Timothy believed. You never hear about him again. That's the last letter that Paul wrote, and he was Paul's boy. And then Paul was dead. Did he go? I think he did. There's only one other mention of Timothy, and it's in the last chapter of the book of Hebrews, which was written to people who expected, once they believed in Jesus, for everything to get easier and to get better and to get brighter. And they found out that it didn't. And he wrote them a letter that said, hold on to Jesus, even if it gets tougher, and even if it gets worse, and even if it gets darker. Because this world isn't our home. And we believe in the one who died for us, and he loves us, and he rose, and he owns us, and he's coming again, and he's going to take us home. Just think about people who did it. Noah did it, he said. Abraham did it. Sarah did it. Joshua did it. And I don't know if you've heard this, but Timothy's been released. Timothy did it. And we're going to come and see you guys. And so, even though I felt like an old man doing a young man's job, on the very last night, they had what they call say-so. And 2/3 of the kids that were there stood up and said that they had accepted Jesus as their personal Savior. And we all did a dance called the Church Clap, which I don't know if you know it, but if you don't, you should learn it. Because I'm going to dance that dance until he comes to take me home.
To find out more about Christ Community Church in Oak Ridge, visit our website at c3oakridge.org. Again, that's c3oakridge.org.